you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Fill her up.
You're listening to the Gas Digital Network.
What is up, my fellow addicts? Ralph Sutton, the SDR show. Really excited to have this dude on. Adam Duritz from Counting Crows. I'll tell the story on the air, but really funny. He was known as quite the cocksmith, as I was told by several people. And just a super, super cool dude and a great band. We do the show every Wednesday, every Saturday, 9 p.m. Eastern time. July 4th weekend is Freedom Weekend on Gas Digital. Everything is free on the website. Every episode ever. HD, commercial free. The chat, the forum. It's all free. And if you sign up for the 1 year during the Freedom Weekend, you get a limited edition Gas Digital Frisbee, a really cool one. It's the only place you can get them is if you sign up for the year during the Freedom Weekend at Gas Digital Network. Use the code SDR, get 20% off the entire network. And here it is right now, the Adam Duritz episode of The Counting Crows on the SDR show.
This is the intro to the shit show. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. This is a hit show. Show me a tit show.
It is the SDR show, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll show. I am Ralph Sutton, back once again. Thank you so much for, I'll say, our almost permanent co-host. That's a strong statement. I kind of want to take it back with his dumb Kango hat, but I'll say it anyway. It is James Madden back once again. Thank you, buddy.
Baby, it's great to be. This is fresh off the presses. Look at this. This is even too cool for Sammy Jackson, baby. Baby Blue.
I don't LL know Cool about Jamie.
That's right, dog.
Shannon back once again. Remember, always follow us everywhere at the SDR show. Leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. Shannon will pick someone random. Let's do it next week, Shannon. We haven't picked a winner in a while for a free t-shirt. And right now, very cool dude. I watched a part of his interview on Joe Rogan. I'm going to give you a nice interview. This, I did a nice introduction this way. Yes, we all know you from Counting Crows. We all know your huge success. But here's what I'm going to say. I know that you're genuinely a nice guy. You know how I know? Go back to 1990 whenever, when you were bigger than life. When Counting Crows' first album is out, millions of records sold, whatever. My brother was a waiter at a restaurant in New York City called Soho Kitchen and Bar. And you had gone in more than once to that restaurant. He served you once. And he called me that day and said he could not have been a nicer guy. So that is straight from the horse's mouth. You're a nice dude. It is Adam Duritz. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
That's really good to hear. You know, I generally am a nice person, but you never know. One of those stories comes up and you're like, maybe that was the one time I, God damn it.
Yeah.
Yeah, never, that's the one.
You never know. That happened to me one time. So I host this thing called Shiprocked, which is a rock cruise that goes on every year. I did it for 10 years, took off last year. But one time I'm running, because they used to run me ragged. Like 1 year I figured I was on stage for about 10 hours throughout the day, hosting different silly things across the boat. And I was running from point A to point B. I had 5 minutes to get there, and it's a big fucking cruise ship. A guy says to me, hey, Ralph, can I please take a quick picture with you? I was like, dude, absolutely, but come with me here. I got to run of this thing or I'm going to be late. And then, of course, the next day on the on this Facebook page, that asshole Ralph is too good to stop for a photo because he made it like he was too important. I'm like, God damn it. The one time.
I was talking to some friends yesterday while we were doing interviews about, I went to the only kind of family reunion thing I've ever been to. I went to my grandmother's 80th birthday and like a lot of extended second and third cousins, you know, people I don't mm-hmm. really know. And I'd been there for about 20 minutes and this woman comes up to me. She's like my mom's age, maybe a little younger than my mom. And she said, hi, okay, so I've got a list here. I need 3 signed CDs and 3 of those, the big pictures. And if you could, I got the names. If you could autograph them too. And she starts talking. I'm like, hey, I don't have any of that stuff. She says, what? I'm like, it's my grandmother's birthday. I'm not carrying CDs with me.
You didn't come to a reunion with a stack full of CDs? What's wrong with you?
She goes, what do you, but I need this. I've got the names. I'm like, I don't have pictures with me. And she says, she looks at me for a second and then she says, you think you're such a big deal. Blood is thicker than water. And then she starts to walk away and she goes, honestly, I don't even like your band.
Oh, I love it. I love that.
Oh, it's great. Thanks.
That's a great story. It's so good. Like, by the way, what a psychopath you would be if you came with a stack of CDs and picks to a family reunion in case somebody wanted one.
Yeah, like, there's no winning there. If you bring the pictures to the party, you're an asshole, and that's showing up on Twitter. If you don't bring the pictures to the party, I'm sure she was on Twitter the next day talking about what an asshole I was.
That's great. That really is awesome.
There's just no fucking winning at all.
And by the way, on a completely different note, another compliment. I don't know how – I think you'll take it as a compliment. How could you not, right?
It is well documented
that you were quite the ladies' man. I don't know what your status is these days, if you're married or single, I'm not sure. But, you know, the one that sticks out is that you dated both Jennifer Aniston and Courteney Cox in the same year during the highlight of Friends, right? You were known as quite the ladies' man. I don't know where you are these days, but my cousin was also part of the New York scene because you lived in New York for a long time. I don't know if you still do, but
yeah.
We're like a fixture.
18 years now.
In the New York, I think you're in the West Village or something like that. But my cousin was part of that like nightclub scene and New York nightlife scene in the late 90s. And when I said, I'm interviewing Adam Duritz tomorrow from the County Crows, and he was part of that scene too, he goes, oh man, that guy was quite the cocksmith.
I was going to say, the proper word is cocksmith. I'm surprised you. No, I have a wonderful girlfriend now. I'm out of that business. But
you're out of the cocksmithing? No more cocksmithing?
No, she's insanely beautiful and amazing, and I really make a huge step up when I met her. But yeah, the correct term is actually cocksmith. I'm surprised you didn't go with that from the beginning.
Yeah, I had not heard. I mean, I kind of heard the term, but the way he said it, it was just like, oh man, yeah, that guy. Woo, what a cocksmith.
I really appreciate his vote. As a former English major and literate soul, I appreciate his vocab right there.
I was impressed with it as well. Yeah. Okay, so now there's a new EP, right? It is called Butter Miracle Suite 1, and there's a Suite 2 on the way as well. Is that correct? In theory, it'd be kind of weird if you called the Suite 1 with no Suite 2.
Well, I came up with the idea of making a suite, and then at some point when I finished it, I was like, wow, that's great. I really love that. And someone said, you should make a second suite to go with it. And I said, yeah. So, yeah. And that's about as deep as the planning goes on this.
Okay.
But I would say it's entirely likely, and I believe it to be the case. But it's the future, and, you know, who knows?
That's what I want to give you credit for.
All of us.
You're embracing it correctly in that in this modern age of technology, like, why do a whole full album? Why do the whole, you know, record, tour, archaic ideology of the 70s and 80s and even 90s? You're putting out singles, EPs, maybe another one, maybe not, who knows? But being able to pivot is what makes a band successful these days, I would think.
And not sucking.
And
although, truthfully, I think as a world, we're open to that too. You could suck. I'm trying very hard not to. At my age, it's really important not to suck because we're not getting points for anything else.
Right. And you've actually, you took a long time off for new music, to my knowledge, right? I think it's 7 years, this new one. Is that right?
Yeah, about that.
So what would you say was the catalyst to say, all right, now's the time. I want to sit down and record a new record.
Nothing really. I had been spending a lot of time. A friend of mine has a farm in the west of England, and I had been spending a lot of time hanging out over there with him. I went over there in, I guess, August of 2019. And it was actually my first day there. My girlfriend was knocked out asleep because she was jet lagged.
She was tired from all the cocksmithing?
Exactly.
It adds up, dog. It adds up.
It's a cumulative effect.
Okay.
And he was at work. I was just washing my face and I shaved my head on a whim. That's why I got rid of my dreads. And then I went out to this farm and he was there some of the time with his family. My girlfriend was there some of the time, but I was also on my own a lot. Just me and two dogs and nothing for miles. And I just got kind of where I wanted to play piano and I hadn't been wanting to for a long time. So hi.
No, sorry, my fan camera went out of sight. I was heiling Hitler. Yeah. You don't do that every hour.
Hi. So I rented a keyboard in London, and a friend of mine drove it down one weekend. And I started playing a little bit, and like the second day, I wrote this song, "The Tall Grass," and the next day, I was sort of playing it back to myself, wondering if it like playing around with the ending, and I changing the chords. I was thinking of extending it, and I seemed pretty cool. And I sang this line, Bobby was a kid from around the town. And I started thinking, oh, maybe I will make the song longer and give it a few movements. And then I thought, oh, no, I think this is actually a different song. And all of a sudden I thought, well, what if I wrote a series of songs where the end of one is the beginning of another and like make a little suite of music, four or five songs. And that got me really excited about writing. And it was the first time I'd really thought about writing or wanting to make a record in a few years, really. So,
do you feel, I mean, just as a guy that is known for obviously music above all else, pressure, I mean, 7 years off of writing, like this is what you do. Did you feel like, why, what's wrong? Why is that switch off in my brain? How do I switch it back on? Did it bother you? Or were you content having that bug not in your ear to write music?
A little bit of both. I mean, I love creating songs. I love, you know, arranging and working with the band and like making records. But I know as soon as I start writing, it gets like a fever. I want to write more. I want to make a record. And then I got to put a record out. And that's the section of it I don't really always love. Mm-hmm. Like everything else is me and six of my best friends. You know, like it gets out there in the world and you deal with a whole other thing. Not that it's bad, but I kind of was burnt out on the record business and that whole thing. So it was a mix. Like there's a part of me that just didn't want to get involved in the rigmarole. We were still touring. I mean, 2019 was the first year we took off touring in 10 years, which I will add, very poor timing.
Well, yeah, because you couldn't tour in 2020. Yeah,
wait, that. 1 year.
That did not work out very well for us. So, you know, we were still working. I just kind of didn't. I was happy playing music. I just didn't want to deal with a record release again. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I know that once I start writing, it's like I cannot stop. It just goes, I want everybody to hear it. You know, I get really excited.
Well, you can stop as soon as Suite 1 is finished, apparently, because Suite 2 is not on the way as far as we understand.
Well,
So you touched on this a little bit. You cut your dreads, I guess it's a year and a half ago, right? Is that what it was?
Yeah.
There's been rumors forever, and I'm not sure why, that your hair was fake, that you wore a wig, that it wasn't real.
They
were extensions.
Yeah, I don't know why it could be rumors. My very first interview with Rolling Stone, I told that I said it was. They were extensions, and then I would kind of grow them out into dreads at times, twist them, keep going, and then I'd pull them out and make extensions because it was just kind of gross at times.
How much of it was your hair? Like how far out? Longer than now? Like
You know, it's all mine at a certain point. I mean.
Oh, I guess that's true.
Because you know, it's like
you bought them.
You're not renting that shit.
Yeah.
They're not taking it back. There's no lease to own program on that stuff. Nor was it imaginary. You know, it was actually happening.
Okay, fair enough.
The percentage I'm quite honestly unaware of.
Oh, okay. I'm just curious. Like, shaving your head, was that a scary thought to be so iconic as the dude with the dreads, albeit extension or not, to be now the guy with no hair?
You know, I've had 30 years of iconic. I think I felt like I ought to be able to sustain it without the fucking dreads.
Yeah, you know? Fair enough.
And if not, then fuck you.
I think we're both Jews. Was there ever an issue of it, especially these days with this crazy amount of, you know, political incorrectness and cultural appropriation, all this other stuff, that maybe that would have a backlash towards you? Or you never even thought about that?
No, I mean, I'm sure it did at times have a backlash, but it was the... Honestly, that was the first time in my life when I had dreads that I looked in the mirror and thought, oh, yeah, that's me. Mm-hmm. Honestly, all the rest of the times, I spent my whole life up until that point looking in the mirror, feeling like, I don't get it. That doesn't look the way I feel. But when I had the dreads, I felt like me for the first time. It was really actually great. And I guess you could call it appropriation. I also would call it some appreciation.
I think it's crazy. You can have styles and people always, you know, I mean, it's crazy to think that you can't adopt a style that you like just because it comes from another culture is insane to me, but whatever.
I get why people say it about some things because there is a certain amount of which it becomes like we're just ripping people off with stuff. But I don't think you can apply it to everything. It's not a blanket thing. You know,
I agree.
People have to have room to love other cultures and appreciate
it. I mean, look,
them.
For God's sake, James is wearing an idiotic Kango. I mean, no one's saying anything about that.
Yo, you're just not up with what's going down, Ralph. You need to get it together, dog. Yeah. Adam, I'll say this. First of all, you look smooth without the dreads. You were awesome with the dreads, but you look smooth without. Who do people say you look like? Do you get any comparisons? Because something just hit to me in the rock and roll realm.
When I was younger now or then?
Right now.
I look a lot like Adam. My mom says I look like Adam Duritz, and that guy is hot.
He's a cocksmith, that guy.
He's a cocksmith. You know, when
baby,
I was a
you
kid,
look like this cocksmith I know called Adam Duritz. Oh, mama, you too kind.
When I was a kid, people before, and he actually became a friend of mine later, and we thought it was true too, but people said that I looked like Robert Downey Jr. when we were both younger. Ooh. Before I knew him, you know. And I think that was kind of true at times. But no, I don't know that anyone said anything. But also, I haven't seen anyone in a year and a half, so I'm not sure who I look like now. What were you going to say, James?
I'm just saying, if you told me you're related to Glenn Danzig, I'd fucking buy it right now.
Glenn Danzig.
Really? I don't know if I see that as much.
And you two's relatives would be the greatest reality show.
What's the name? The guy from Social Distortion. I think you look a little.
Oh, Mike Ness.
Yeah, you look a little like Mike Ness. I feel.
You know, I met Glenn Danzig when I was first, like, my first week in the record business. Because I went down. What happened there?
She's showing Glenn Danzig.
Oh, there's Glenn. There's Glenn. Yeah, I went to meet him. Like, I went to my manager's office. My first managers also managed Danzig.
Awesome.
And I was in the office one day. I walked in to say hi and do something. I think we were making the record then, the first record. And Glenn's there. And they introduced us, and he stood up and glowered at me. I mean,
like this. He had a glower like this because he's like 5'4".
Right. And he gave me this, like, kind of terrifying look. But then he walked over to say hi while looking, like, very intimidating. But, yeah, he was 5'4", and so it wasn't as intimidating. He was actually pretty nice after that. But at first, I felt like there was something that bothered him about me, and he kind of, like, caught up in my face slash chest. But then he was actually really nice after that. He's not a tall guy, but, I mean, he is Glenn Danzig, which is very cool.
You know? Maybe he knew your relatives, and he was upset that you did not bring 8x10s to the reunion.
That's very possible.
Saying, dog.
It's also possible he knew my relatives hated them, and therefore, like, took it out on me. Maybe they asked him. Maybe we were. I don't know. Is he Jewish?
That's a good question. I don't know. Maybe he's short.
If I was going to bet, I'm going to bet.
I got to interview him a couple of times over the years, and he was always nice. I met him once in person, and I mean, I'm 6'5" and a half, so our picture together looks ridiculous because he's a short guy, and he had a broken arm, and he was always big. But I posted the picture and said, you know, Glenn shouldn't have cracked wise to me, and a lot of his fans got pissed at that, like implying that I beat him up. Yeah. I don't know why that people would get mad.
I had a great afternoon one time with Ralph Sampson, and we hung out and talked for hours, and then we took a picture together. She's really good friends of a friend of mine. It's the greatest picture. I look like I'm like 4 feet tall, stumpy. Because everybody, Ralph Sampson looks like a normal human being. He's just like perfectly proportioned, really handsome man. He just happens to be 7'2", 7'4". Mm-hmm. You know, like everybody.
Look at Shannon lighting up. You saw Shannon's face? She's like 7'2". Hello.
Also, he was born to a Protestant family of Italian, German, and Scottish heritage. His real last name is Anzalone.
Oh, well, there we go.
Glenn or Ralph Sampson?
Glenn. I would imagine Glenn.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, that's funny. He was always a nice. It's funny how the Misfits can tour stadiums and Danzig tours halls. You know, I mean, still will do 1,000 people, but Misfits will do Madison Square Garden. It's crazy how that happens. Is that also why I would guess, counting, because you did put out a solo record, you did that cover of The Cars. That was a great Cars cover.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't call that a solo record.
It was a couple of singles, whatever you want to call it.
I was sitting around one Valentine's Day after my girlfriend and I had broken up, and it was the week before Valentine's Day, and I just thought to myself, I don't want to be a total loser and be moping about my ex-girlfriend. I went on Twitter and I said, I'm going to learn a song and cover it every day for a week. And I did it, like, on my phone. I recorded them all on my iPhone or my computer. Wow. And at the end of it, I said, you know what? We'll have a contest. You guys design the cover, and I'll pick the winners, and we'll press up a vinyl for everyone of the two winners or something, and then I'll send them to everyone that was part of the contest. We'll send you free vinyl. So it wasn't like a record we sold. I made it for the fans, basically.
I really love that cover, that Rick Cars cover of You Might
Have. It's really good, isn't it? That's really a great one.
Yeah, it's a really good cover.
I was proud of that.
All right, before we go any further, I am thrilled that these guys are back on the network. It is Blue Chew. And I will tell you this, the Blue Chew Chewables, there's a guy on the network, one of the other hosts, called me the other day. He's like, dude,
You got any more chewables? I need one this weekend immediately, because you, they know it works. It works. It has the same active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis, but in a chewable form and at a fraction of the cost. Blue Chew's tablets mean harder, stronger erections and combats all forms of erectile dysfunction, including having to look at Shannon, because that is one of the strongest forms of erectile dysfunction. Blue Chew is online prescription service. No need to go to a doctor's office. No awkward conversations. And the best thing is, we've all done the chewables here. We all know it works. We are your test subjects. So just trust us when we tell you. Especially, you don't have to swallow pills. It happens discreetly. You just go to bluechew.com. Use the code SDR. You get your chewables for free. You just pay the $5 shipping. And we could not be happier that Blue Chew is sponsoring this podcast. Once again, go to bluechew.com. Use the code SDR. Your first month is free. You just pay the $5 shipping. All right, let's get back into it. In watching the Joe Rogan interview, I saw you said you wrote, the first time you ever wrote a song wasn't until college in chemistry class, which I would imagine for most people who make a living in music, that's later than most to sit down and decide, oh, this is what I want to do for a living. Am I right?
I think so too. I mean, it was freshman fall term, so right at the beginning. It was about a month into college, but yeah, it's my first time. I think it was a little late, but I got signed at first time anyone from a record company came to see one of my bands. I was 27. I got signed at 28, and our first record came out at 29. So, you know, I had spent 10 years in the clubs.
Wow, and that's a bizarre story, because the thing, and I'm not even exactly sure how this happened, so hopefully you could elaborate. Back then, your album's not even out yet, and yet somehow you play the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, that was weird. We were in the middle of making the first record, and we'd gone home to Berkeley for like a week. We were getting ready to come back to finish up things, and I got a phone call that Van Morrison was getting inducted, but he wasn't coming. And Robbie Robertson, they initially thought they were going to get Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers to do it, but Robbie Robertson from the band was the music director at that point, and he had met us. He knew us. He's the guy that suggested we make a record in a house, actually. And he said, actually, no, I got a band. They're making a record up in the hills right now. Let's get them. They'd be great for this. I think we're still the only unknowns ever to play the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
That's really bizarre. That had to be quite, I would imagine, a lot of pressure to walk in as unknowns and be around, you know, superstars, I would imagine, at that point.
It was really cool. I mean, we went out to the rehearsal. That call came in on a Sunday. We were in Berkeley. So we flew down that night, stopped at Tower Records on the way, picked up some cassettes to try and figure out a song to do. Mm-hmm. Figured out a version of Caravan that night. And then Monday, the next day, was the rehearsal. Tuesday was the show. So we go out to the Valley Monday. We pull up to this little rehearsal studio that we've actually used many times since then, but I'd never been there then. And I could hear through the door, Roadhouse Blues is playing, and it's a really good version of it by the Doors. And I open the door to go in, and yeah, it's actually the Doors with Eddie Vedder singing.
That's crazy.
And I look around the room, and there's like Robbie, Jim Keltner, the drummer, Ben Montench, Clapton, Jack Bruce, Springsteen, John Fogerty. I mean, they're all standing around Jesus. The walls of this room, like hanging out in a little rehearsal space.
Did you walk up and say, "Back up, amateurs, I got this"?
Accidentally kind of like that, because they finish the thing and they're done. We go play basketball for a little while, shooting hoops with Eddie, and they call us back in. And Robbie's like, "So, what song are you guys going to do?" And I said, "Caravan." Just three of us. And he says, "Okay, well, do you want us all to play?" Gesturing around the room to like the greatest musicians ever. I mean, the house band is Don Was on bass, Jim Keltner on drums, Robbie and Bruce on guitar, Ben Montench on keyboards, the Heartbreakers keyboard mm-hmm. player. I think that's the whole band. So it's an insane house band. Plus, you know, everybody else. He's like, "So you want the band behind you?" And I said, "No, it's okay. We got it." And it wasn't thinking about it at the time. We had figured out a version. I thought it was really good, and I didn't want to be a hassle to anybody. You know, I wasn't really thinking about quite how arrogant that sounded. You know, but I said, no, we got it. And there's silence for a second, and I realize what I've done. And then everybody just busts up. They're laughing. And Robbie's like, "Okay, well, why don't you guys play it, and we'll see." And I said, "Oh, okay, you know." So we played our version. And when it was over, Robbie said, "Oh, actually, that's actually really cool. How about... maybe Ben Mont comes in on organ on the second verse." I said, "Okay." He goes, "Okay, let's try that." And we did it. And he goes, yeah, that's fine. Let's just do that. So we, but I mean, initially I did kind of say,
that's great. I love it.
No, we got it.
Guys, back up. We got it. We figured it out already. We don't need you guys. Just to get away from us.
Well, I felt like, you know, I mean, it was really cool being around all those people, but I wasn't really nervous about playing music. I mean, it's kind of the one place in my life I was comfortable. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I wasn't as good as I felt like we were then, but I felt like confident. You're not going to go down there to play the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame unless you're confident that you could do it. You know what I mean? And we showed up. We had a version. I thought it was really cool, just acoustic guitar and mandolin and me. And, you know, it was good. It's just that it probably shouldn't have been good. But I was confident. You know, I didn't mean it to be arrogant. I really just meant it to be not a problem. It didn't. Thankfully, we rescued it by actually being pretty good right then, and everyone was really cool to us.
I see that James is poised to ask a question. Go,
James, please. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, Adam, first of all, everything you just said blew my mind. I mean, that was one of the greatest rock and roll classes of all time. But then that you said that you played basketball with Eddie Vedder. Did you please tell me some of the British please tell me members of the Doors, CCR, and Cream played basketball. Please tell me stories of Eric Clapton airballing a jump shot. That would be the greatest story, and Ginger Baker calling him a pussy.
Well, no, make it up if you have to, Adam.
I'll give you some classic rock and roll stuff here, though. After we'd finished our thing, we stayed around because Cream was supposed to rehearse next. And Ginger Baker wasn't there yet, which is classic Ginger Baker.
What a shock, Adam.
He showed up like 3 or 4 hours late. But we were standing in that room. And, you know, this is like the 92, I guess. You know, Clapton's a pretty big pop star at that point. But, you know, he's like acoustic songs and that version of Layla from The Unplugged. You know, he hasn't, you know, ripped anyone's head off with his guitar in a while. And it was easy to take him for granted right then a little bit. But he's standing around, he's talking to Jack Bruce, and he's kind of forgotten the riff to one of the songs. I think it was Sunshine of Your Love. And he's kind of like, I fucking can't remember how this goes. And Jack's like, oh, no. And he grabs his bass, plugs it into something. Clapton's standing in front of this Marshall stack with a cheetah skin. It's not his. It's just one in the rehearsal studio. Like a cheetah skin cover on it. It couldn't look more cheesy. But with his guitar. And Jack Bruce like plays the lick to him. And Clapton goes, oh, yeah, okay. And he plays it. Just standing there by himself playing this lick. And the tone, the shockingly visceral sound of this guy just standing there playing his guitar for a second blew my mind. And everything that I had ever taken for granted about Eric Clapton out the window. I mean, just from a couple notes, I just stood there and was just like, oh my God, that's some visceral shit. And I gotta say, the next night at that Hall of Fame thing, because Cream played. And it's the I realized in the middle of it, I'm the first guy in my generation to see Cream. Like, no one's seen Cream play in 20, 30 years at that point. And I guess 20 years. And it was insane. I mean, it was so good. I stood there. It was me, Immer on my right, and George Clinton on my left.
Jesus.
Because he was inducting Sly and the Family Stone. And I will say this as well. He asked me for the first autograph I've ever been asked for in my life. I came off stage at that thing at the sound check. And when I came back up there, he's like, hey, can I get your autograph, man? Because we were sitting at the same table together. George Clinton.
Really?
And I said, no way. No way, man. You got to give me your autograph first, because otherwise the world is upside down, man. I grew up in Oakland, man. I'm a huge P-Funk is everything, you know. And for George Clinton to ask me, I said, no, I will give it to you, but you have to give me yours first, because I can't deal with giving you my autograph.
I mean, but
otherwise.
That's so cool that he, you know, I always love hearing the idea how rock stars are fans of rock stars. That you see something in someone and you're like, oh yeah, I'm that guy's gonna be something. Or, you know, other. I think, you know, you guys understand each other and you get each other's modalities or whatever. It's wild to see.
I think it's true in music more than in most art forms. You know, I've said this a lot. But I lived in L.A. for a long time, and a lot of my friends worked in the, you know, film and TV, you know, and they love to talk about this actor that sucks or this movie that sucks. Musicians just want to shove their latest mixtape down your throat. They just want to tell you about who they like. They just want to yak for hours about like some band that you don't know yet, but you will love them. You know,
I think James would agree that comedy is very similar in that you could see a comic go up and just know, oh, that guy's going to be something. That guy's got a good take on something.
I agree. Comics really appreciate other comics. They'll help. They'll write for each other. They're very, very supportive.
Yeah, you know? I know you're friends with a shit ton of comics, right?
I am, yeah. I admire them maybe more than any other art form. I think comedy is like, That's terrifying. That's a fucking high wire act. That's the trapeze. I mean, because I can play a concert. I don't care what anyone in the audience is doing. They don't. I don't give a shit what they're doing. We're gonna play. It's gonna be great, you know. But comics, they're so dependent on audience. They have to ride that. It's like surfing, man. It blows my mind.
The fascinating thing, and James is actually one of the people that falls into this category as well. Is so many comics want to be rock stars, and so many rock stars want to be comics. It's a fascinating connection where every comic I know wants, like, is envious of the rock star, like, bravado of stage presence, because part of being a comic is being vulnerable. It's like a 180 of that. And then every comic, every rock star loves the idea of being one-on-one with an audience and having, it's relying on you. Do you agree, James? Is that a fair statement?
I would go so far to say I'm a failed musician who ended up realizing my bands were funnier than good. And so I ended up doing comedy. That's really it. I can't sing for shit. I used to kind of like try and hum a little, like the verses, like I was a poor Lou Reed. And then someone's like, you should just say jokes. And here it is. Yeah. If I could sing, there'd be some real fucking problems. That's all I'm telling everybody.
I've never wanted to be a comic, but I am in awe of it. I mean, I am so in awe of what they do, because like it's the improvisational nature of it too, not just the live. I identify with the live part, you know, and that's why, I think that's why I like theater as well, because the fact that people go out there and do it every night, I totally get that. But the nonstop improvisational nature of comedy is insane to me. You know?
Let me ask you on that, because you were known, I've only seen you guys once, but you guys were known for your song rants, your discussions about the songs between songs. Could you, and sometimes there were interesting stories, funny story, whatever. There's always was something to that. In a way, are you getting your fill of that at that moment? Are those scripted? Were those made up off the cuff?
Well, I do a lot of improvisation inside songs. Like I'm always kind of rewriting the song as I'm singing it. The stuff when I wrote speaking parts to talk about songs, I worked on those. I wrote them. I worked on like the timing, because you don't want to lose the audience. And when I decided a few years ago to start doing like introductions to songs, I worked on those. I wouldn't have been able to do those off the top of my head. I worked on them and wrote them. You know,
I mean, comics do that also. You know, they're working on their jokes all the time. So you could argue that. You said somewhere that you feel that it's those stories. And I felt this way. There's a singer I love. I don't know if you ever heard of him, Damien Rice. Do you know who that is?
Yeah, Damien opened for us on his first record years ago.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I love him.
Amazing.
And watching his stories made me connect more with some of the songs that I may have not connected with before. And you said that as well in an interview, that songs that might have been under the radar Crow songs, when there's a story behind it, it connects more with people.
I think it really worked. And there were several songs that I started doing that with that weren't particularly well-known songs, and people really, really responded to them after that in the way they hadn't before. I think he's absolutely right.
Right. It's an interesting thing.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
By the way, I failed miserably. You made a list of 10 albums that you thought were essential for everyone to listen to. And I knew 3 of them. I mean, and I felt really bad that I knew the De La Soul, the Miles Davis, and the Dashboard Confessional. But the others, I think the other 7, I was unaware of. I don't remember. I don't have the list in front of me. But I went through them like, man, I failed miserably on Adam's test of cool rock and roll music.
No. That's why I made that list.
Oh, you did it specifically for things you don't think people ever listen to.
Well, part of it was that, because, you know, you get asked to make these lists all the time. I've probably done 30 of them already on just this album cycle. I don't want to do the same one every time, but I do want to turn people on to great music a lot of the time. So sometimes you want to make stuff that people should check out that they might not have thought of, but like that this is a great record, great band, you know. Because the obvious stuff, well, it's already obvious, and they've already got it.
Right,
exactly. What good does that do anybody, you know?
And I'll say
also, Bravo on Big Star, my friend. Bravo. Ah, Big Star is one of the most beautiful bands that no one knows of. Fuck yeah, Adam. I love you even more. I didn't think it was possible, Adam. I love you even more, bro.
That was like, you know, when I was younger, like, because people don't even realize this nowadays, but there was a time when you couldn't find music. Because vinyl was really temporary, and it would go out of print. And there were, when I was growing up, I had all this, I had a list of albums that I had read about, heard about, and couldn't find anywhere. And I like the Modern Lovers, Big Star, Fairport Convention, and Richard Linda Thompson, Billy Bragg. And I went on a trip with my parents to England when I was a kid, and I spent that entire trip, like every town we went to, every record store I could find, I went through the used bins and the regular bins because stuff was, you know, in print there. And I had to buy a suitcase. I came home with this. Like, that's where I got all my Big Star records. It was like this trip to Europe when I was a kid. And I came home and like turned myself on to the band that was probably the biggest influence in my life. But wow. I went and sought out all those records because I'd been wanting to hear them for years.
One of the things I miss the most, you can't really do it now. You get recommendations from Spotify or iTunes, but going to a record store and just thumbing through and saying, oh, this looks cool, I'll buy this. You discover bands that you've never would have ever heard before. Like, I bought a band, you've never heard of them. They're like a funky, old white guys would sound funny, called Mother's Finest. Not Mother's Finest. Mother's Finest is another one, though, that I found.
Mother Hips?
I can't remember the name. I have to find. The name of the song was Institution Man. I forgot the name of the fucking group, though. But I found these great records that I would have never found if I just wasn't thumbing through a CD or an album store. And that's gone.
Yeah, I think it's one of the problems. I mean, Spotify is great because you can hear anything anytime. But the problem with getting whatever you want is there's no way to know that you want things you haven't heard yet. You know, that was the thing that good radio would do for us. I mean, that's why I actually use Pandora a lot, because I have some radio stations that I've kind of designed by coming up with bands I like.
But they have far less of a catalog, Pandora. Yeah. They purposefully want to make sure you're going to like what they recommend. Mother Earth was the name. Thank you, Shannon. I was close. I said Mother's Finest. But that's why I don't like it. It's a good thing and a bad thing with Pandora is that there's so much that's not on there that you're going to miss, but at least you know the ones they recommend once you've done that algorithm are going to hit.
Yeah, I mean, I just like, I'll have it running in the house playing stuff, and if I really like something, I'll just screenshot it. And then I keep a list of those in my phone and just like go back and find those things you screenshot, buy those records and check out those bands. It's good for our festival too. Discover a lot of stuff that way.
The crazy thing is one of your first major tours as Counting Crows was opening for the Stones. Is that right? I think it was.
Well, it was like we'd been around for a bit there. We did the Stones the first summer after the record came out, and we had gotten pretty big. We were also, they asked us to open the whole Voodoo Lounge tour, and we said, well, we have our first headline summer tour was that summer. Mm-hmm. So we were big enough to have a headline tour. So we asked them if we could just do like 8 or 10 gigs. And then we fit their gigs in between our gigs that summer. But yeah, it was about a year into it.
That was their 30th anniversary, and now it's your 30th anniversary. That's just, I can't imagine young cocksmithy Adam Durst at 20-something is like, yeah, I'm going to still be doing this 30 years later. It's just a crazy idea.
Well, I remember that because it's 94, and that's exactly the thought I had at the time was, well, okay, well, we're opening for the Stones on our first record, 94. They were about 61, 62, so it's been about 30 years since they started, and I was like, wow, that's wild to be around 30 years and still be making new music that people are into, because Voodoo Lounge, people bought that record.
Great record. And it's a good record.
And there was an incredible tour. I loved touring with them. I saw every show, and I remember thinking, wow, 30 years, that's amazing. And then, yeah, I had forgotten about it until someone asked me about it on this cycle in an interview. But yeah, now it's been 30 years for us. And, you know, we've never been as clearly not as big as they are. We've never been that successful or that big. But we're still here. We're still making new music that people are listening to. We've got a hit song right now, which is, that's the real measure of it. Like, well, very few bands ever last. But can you last and still be and not be like a legacy band, not be just like playing your greatest hits in the summertime? So yeah, it's really wild. I don't even know how to process that, but I know exactly what you mean.
I don't think it's all of you, but a good chunk of you are the same original group of guys that started 30 years ago. It's like three or four of you.
Five of us. Yeah.
Five of us. That's pretty wild to say that's the same crew I mean, how many bands could say that? It's fucking crazy that that's going on.
We have a lot of our crew, too, from then.
Wow.
I mean, other than people that have passed away, almost no one's left.
I mean, Shannon's worked for me for 35 years. Is that right, Shannon?
That's about right.
Looking good, Shan.
Thanks.
All right, before we go any further, we're about to celebrate July 4th weekend, and what a better way to celebrate your freedom than going to YoKratom.com and grabbing yourself a couple of $60 kilos to bring in that Independence Day. Why the fuck not? We know it's high quality, wholesale, direct to your door, no questions asked Kratom. So if you're a fan of Kratom, this is where you want to go. Go to YoKratom.com. You've purchased gas station garbage before for Kratom. You know you don't want to do that. You want high-quality, reliable Kratom. Go to YoKratom.com. It's home of the $60 kilo. You know Shannon loves it, too. Go get some high-quality Kratom now at YoKratom.com. All right, let's get back into it. Also, by the way, another thing that I thought were fascinating, I'm going to hit a couple of quick things that we don't have all the time in the world with you. The first band was the Himalayas or something, but you had written Round Here with them and then brought it to Counting Crows. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, Himalayans was a counting, Round Here was a Himalayan song that I wrote with my other bandmates. I only wrote the lyrics to that. I didn't write much of the music, if any. Yeah, that was a Himalayan song.
And you just brought it over, and it wasn't a, because it was you wrote it, so it wasn't a problem to bring it over. You know what
I
mean?
Well, I wrote it with the other guys in the Himalayans. But what happened was, there was a version of Counting Crows before that, and I had, that broke up. I joined Himalayans, and I'd been in it for a couple years. I was in two or three bands. I was in this band Sordid Humor, too. And I was just kind of playing acoustic shows with Dave Bryson, one of the guitar players in Counting Crows. So that band wasn't even together, really. And we started playing Round Here at our acoustic shows because he really loved the song. And so then we kind of put together a band to play some new Counting Crows songs. I think I'd written Rain King and Mr. Jones and a few other songs. And we wanted to do another recording session, so we put a band together, and then we really loved playing together. So that version of Counting Crows stayed, and we started playing a band version of Round Here as well. So,
by the way, I was a strip club DJ, which I say all the time, and the fans of the show hate me saying it so much, but it was true. And boy, was Mr. Jones a strip. Every girl in that club, every white chick for sure, but every girl like loved dancing to Mr. Jones. During those like two or three years, that first record was everywhere. I probably played it 1,000 times at a strip club.
I you know, when your first time on the road, it's kind of weird, and it's weird to be away from home that much. It's weird. You've never lived like that, playing gigs, being in hotels, like not knowing anybody anywhere you are. And you know, we went to strip clubs a few times. It's just the only place to sort of talk to girls, and you know, not, you know, and just like we would do it a few times. And what cured me of it is that they kept playing Mr. Jones. Like there was nothing, I couldn't hang it. It was fun. Strip clubs, I actually really enjoyed it at times. It was a fun night out. But they kept playing Mr. Jones, yeah. And I was like, yeah, I'm done. I told this anymore
on the show, and I apologize for repeating this, but it was almost a law to the DJ by management. If a star comes in, a rock star or a movie star, you had to play the song that people knew them from. So, like, I remember Michael Anthony Hall came in, and at the time, we had to play, like, stuff from, you know, what was the movie where he built the girl? Weird Science. I had to play Weird Science because
he came.
So
you just played Oingo Boingo nonstop.
Oingo Boingo. Like, yeah, I didn't want to do that, but we were told you have to do that. So and to all the DJs that played that while you were there, I feel their pain.
No, there are states in the South where there are still laws on the books that you have to play Mr. Jones in strip clubs.
I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's Mississippi still, and Alabama, it's still
you gotta,
there.
You go to jail for that shit. I'm sure. No. Yeah. Why did you stop the Underwater Sunshine podcast? You started it up again about 6 months ago, and then you stopped.
Oh, pandemic.
But you could still do. Look, we're doing it right now. Right?
Yeah, we didn't want to do it because so much of a big part of that podcast is sitting in the room together, listening to music and playing it for each other.
You could still do it, buddy. It takes a little time to get used to. You think I want to do it like this? You're in New York. We could have brought you into the studio, for God's sake.
Well, we were actually going to... This is actually your fault, okay? And fuck you. We were supposed to start again this week because I told them I had all the press leading up to the release of the record, and then I was going to be free. I'm going to England in like 2 weeks, but I was going to have this week, and we were going to do a bunch of podcasts this week, but... Honestly, we got overwhelmed with the press requests, and I'm working every day this week too. But we were supposed to start yesterday. We were going to do Monday and Wednesday doing podcasts, try and do two or three each day. And we can't because I'm in this shit all day long. So, yeah, that's right, Ralph. Fuck you.
All right, I'll take it. I'll love it. By the way, because you're a New Yorker and also I watched your Instagram, you are super passionate about food. So am I. Right? I went to cooking school. Let's have a fucking Adam versus Ralph throwdown. You pick the item. I'll make it better than you. We'll throw it out in the studios.
Why don't we just make dinner some night and eat it?
All right, we could do that too.
I'm not really into competitive cooking, but I love eating.
We could share our favorite restaurants in New York, by the way, because you're in the West Village. I'm in the East Village. So
no, I'm in the East Village.
Oh, you are? Holy yeah, shit. Yeah. Our studios are in Alphabet City. I live on B and 10th, so
you're right. You're a few blocks away.
Okay, oh, really? Yeah. Hilarious. I'm going to tell you my favorite breakfast place in our hood, C&B. You ever go to C&B?
No.
Oh, my God, dude.
But I love breakfast. You know that the Mexican joint, La Palapa?
La Palapa's great. Yeah, they
have
on
great
St. Mark's.
Chilaquiles and huevos.
I'm going to educate you on the great food of the East Village, my friend.
I am available for that.
All right, and now to do a little bit of a serious note, you're very open, and I didn't do enough research that I can sound like I know what I'm talking about, so I apologize. But you're very open that you have some sort of dissociative disorder that every once in a while makes you forget how to play piano and you have to relearn it. Could you elaborate a little bit on that? Because that sounds awful, and I didn't do enough research on it, and I apologize.
No, it's I have a dissociative disorder. It makes the world look like you're looking at it from a distance, kind of, and that you're just kind of removed from things at times. I don't know whether the piano problem is an artifact of that or not, but I have trouble retaining things sometimes. Mm-hmm. And you know, when I don't play for a while, I've never become a great piano player. And I think partially because it just doesn't accumulate. Like I play and then I can't remember how to play.
Like it a 50 first date situation.
Yes.
Okay.
No. I don't know. I probably had at least 50 first dates, but I'm not sure.
I'm sure.
Yeah. The second one, so that's the rough one.
I
don't know. You know, it's hard. I don't seem to have the facility when I haven't played for a while. And I just have to kind of relearn how to do it. I've never gotten good enough to play by ear.
Does it happen with other parts of music? Like, do you forget lyrics? Do you forget that stuff? Or is it just with piano?
It's mostly just the piano. I mean, lyrics, yeah, there are a lot of words. I do blank out sometimes on that stuff. I keep a songbook on stage, but it's at the back of the stage. There's no way to really get to it in time if I forget something.
They don't have teleprompters? I thought they did that, some bands.
No, I guess you could. I have never gotten a teleprompter. Huh. That just seems weird. You'd have to hire a guy to roll it, too.
I guess that's true. I know these days with voice recognition, it probably could churn along as you're singing. I don't know if that's true, but
I make up a lot of stuff in songs, too.
That would cause a problem.
That might not help. I make up lyrics sometimes. I change words. I don't think a teleprompter could handle it. Also, I just don't think I want to be reading something during a song.
Right.
I mean, if I forget something, I'll run back and look at it. But I don't want to be looking at it.
And probably from the fan's perspective, it looks like you're just running back to do cocaine every 5 minutes, and that works out perfectly.
It's perfect. And then getting there and finding no cocaine because it's like, oh, it's too late. Yeah. I remember this line. Okay, you stay there. I'll be back.
Exactly. And I also love, by the way, this last story, then we're going to wrap up with the first question, that you still worked as a bartender even when Counting Crows the album is selling millions. You still were at the Viper Room as a bartender. Is that right?
I wasn't at the Viper Room as a bartender until after we were really famous.
Oh, that's fucking even better. Can you elaborate, please?
The only people I knew in L.A. really were people, at first, other than a few friends, were the people who worked at the Viper Room. And I can't remember how Sal and Johnny and I met. But the people on the staff there were people that I'd met through other friends. And, like, those are the people I knew really well. And when we got home from touring on the first album, it was about a year and a half of touring. And there were people camped out on my lawn. And it was just like a nightmare in Berkeley. And I got a phone call one day from Sal and Johnny, Johnny Depp and Sal Janko. And they started telling me about a party they wanted to invite me to. And I think it was pretty clear I wasn't doing very well. And they said, what's wrong? And I sort of explained what had been happening. It's kind of Beatlemania in the Bay Area. And they put me on hold. They came back about 5 minutes later and they said, okay, look, we're having a party here tonight. It's Kate Moss's 21st birthday. We want to invite you. You have a reservation on Southwest at 7, Oakland to Burbank. Someone will come pick you up. We got you a room at the Bellage. You need to get the hell out of there. And I was like, okay. And I left and went to this party and I never really went back. I moved to LA after that. I stayed down there. And after a little, I was always hanging out at the Viper Room because they were the only people I knew. And it was less crowded on the other side of the bar. So I would be hanging out over there, you know, kind of serving drinks every now and then. And Shannon McManus, who was the main bartender there at one point, said, hey, I got, you know, she had to go to the bathroom. She's like, will you just watch the bar? I said, sure. Mm-hmm. So I browbeat people for tips. I knew how to work everything by then. I wasn't sure. If I didn't, I just said, I'll get you a beer.
Did people assume that you just, wow, Counting Crows money must suck if you're here? Like, is that what people thought?
I don't know. She came back and I'd made so much money for her on tips. She was like, you should do this all the time. And I was honestly hanging out on that side of the bar with her all the time anyways.
Okay. And please tell me that you cocksmithed your way into Kate Moss's 21st birthday, or did that not happen?
Well, she was Johnny's girlfriend. And I was there's no way to get anywhere with Johnny's girlfriend. He's still Johnny Depp. I wasn't going anywhere in that. But no, that party was wild because literally at that time when there were, you know, legitimate like supermodels, real supermodels, you know, like Elle McPherson and all, every single one of them was at that party.
Wow.
It was my first experience with really Hollywood, and it was crazy. That place was amazing though, because it was everyone from like people like that to Tom Petty, to Gibby Haynes, to William Burroughs, Allen Ginsberg. I hang out with all those guys there. It was like what the Left Bank of Paris must have been like in the 20s. It was an amazing hang for a few years there.
I only got to go there. I went there once after the fact. Like, it wasn't as popular. But when Steel Panther, I'm sure you know those guys. I saw when they were still doing their residency there. So I think it was probably, I'm going to guess, 99 or 2000. So it had lost. It still was a fun place, but it wasn't the Viper Room that when you were there. It was like 95, 96, I guess. That was the
Years were 95 was right when I moved there. I think it was January of 95. And those years, for the next two or three years, it was just an amazing place. There were so many interesting people. Like, I remember sitting in the little hidden room, me and Johnny, and I'm sitting next to Allen Ginsberg, eating Mexican food, watching Adam Ant play. Like, Jesus. It was insane. It was such a great place to be. I've said insane so many times in this interview that it's insane.
It's insane.
You haven't said it enough, Adam. You haven't said it enough because it's... Adam, if I could be in the matrix of your mind, it'd be the happiest thing of my life. Everything you have just said, you're eating Mexican food with a beat. This is the craziest thing I've ever heard.
And by the way, remember earlier in the interview, he backdoor referenced that he's also friends with fucking Robert Downey Jr. I caught that reference, too.
Well, one of the first people I met there outside of the Viper Room, we played a show at the Roxy, and Sean Penn came, and he came backstage, and we started talking, and we became really good friends. And when I moved to L.A., we used to go do stuff all the time. He calls me up, he goes, hey, what are you doing? I'm going to go hang out with some high school friends. You want to come? I said, yeah, sure. So he picks me up in this, he had this Grand National, remember those cars? Like the, but they go about 1,000 miles an hour, but they look like...
Yeah, they were good drag racing cars, like for the street racing. One of my friends used to do that all the time in Brooklyn.
So he picks me up in Laurel Canyon, and we drive out to Malibu in probably about 12 minutes, which is, it's a 45-minute to an hour drive. He got there in like 8 minutes. It was terrifying. But we pull up to this house. We walk in, and it's like, it's Emilio Estevez, Robert Downey Jr. I forgot. This is who you went to high school with. I was like, his high school experience, not my high school experience. But Robert was an incredible musician too. And he and I really hit it off that night. He was such a, like, one of the smartest, most brilliant guys I've ever met. Like a mind that works like a lot of my comic friends. His mind is so fast. He could just do these. He didn't. One night we were just all sitting around getting drunk, and he launched into this Frank Sinatra impersonation where for 45 minutes he just sang Sinatra, clips of Sinatra songs. He'd sing like a half of a verse or a chorus, and then he'd break into the patter, hysterical patter for 2 minutes, and then into another song, and then back as Sinatra doing patter, like hysterical, dirty, dirty Sinatra patter, plus like, but he just did it for 40 minutes off the top of his head. Just, you know, that's that comic mind thing.
Would you say that it was so good that it was... insane?
Insane? Perhaps I would. James, I appreciate you appreciating me. I want you to know that.
Well, this just became Pee-wee's Playhouse. I just feel like we have a word of the day now. I'm going to put all the styrofoam together, or the whatever the thing was, that big ball.
Three quick last one-hitter questions, and then we'll do the first. Number one, is it true that you always hated the Counting Crows song Einstein on the Beach, or is that also a fallacy?
No, I don't hate it. I like it. It's just that it was a demo. It was a demo that we recorded back before we even got signed. And it was never even considered as a song for the record. Because I think it's clever, but not really truly good. Just kind of clever and hooky. So it was a song that I thought of as a nothing song. And at some point, Geffen asked me for something for this DGC Rarities album. So I just wanted to give them as a cute song. I thought it'd be fun for people to hear it, but it was nothing. You know, it was going to a record that no one was ever going to hear. Mm-hmm. Cut to like a year later, I've told Geffen after we've done two singles, Mr. Jones and Around Here, that I will no longer release any singles off the record, that it's too big and I want it to like be reasonable and stop. I want things to sort of stop before they get out of hand. They then said, oh, they were really mad. But then they finally said, okay. And they released the DGC Rarities album, a record they would never normally promote. And they promoted Einstein as a single. The next single was supposed to be Ranking. I would much have preferred Ranking. Huh. Einstein's a great song, but I was trying to shut an album down. And the most pop song we ever accidentally recorded suddenly is number one on the radio charts.
Right,
it was
right.
The last thing I wanted. It's a song that's, it's like, we've never, I think we played it live once, you know, before we were even signed. It's nothing that was ever important to me. So the fact that it was a huge release at a time when I was trying to calm the record down a little bit.
That makes sense.
I was afraid of backlash, you know. The record was so big.
It is crazy to think how it was just omnipresent. It was fucking everywhere. It was crazy. It was so big. And then the title track, which was not on the original album, is coming out as part of this, or is that not right?
Yeah, it's on the vinyl. It's the B-side of the vinyl.
That's crazy. That was Why would you hold on to that for fucking 25 years, whatever that is, 26 years at this point?
It was a song I had written and that I intended for the first album, but I realized when we were recording that, A, it was too long. It was a 10-minute piano song. I couldn't play it very well because I'm not that good on piano. And you couldn't edit piano back then. The overtones from a piano with tape don't work. And I also realized at the time it wasn't good enough. There were some holes in it lyrically where I'd written some easy things because it was like a 10-minute song, you know? Mm-hmm. What actually happened was we'd spent the whole day trying to record that song, and River Phoenix and Samantha Mathis were visiting because they were making a movie with T-Bone right then. And they were in the studio, and T-Bone got frustrated with me fucking this song up over and over again and said, let's take a minute, a break. And he left the room, and I said to our engineer, hey, I have this song I wrote. I want to give it to Bonnie Raitt. I just have to do a quick demo of it. Will you just push record? And I played the song I'd written called Raining in Baltimore, which I had been planning to give to Bonnie Raitt. She'd been really nice to me when I was like unknown, and I wanted to give her a song because she didn't write a lot of her own songs. And when I finished the song, I looked up, T-Bone's back in the room, and he says, what the fuck is that? I go, it's the song Raining in Baltimore. I'm giving it to Bonnie Raitt. He's like, yeah, fuck Bonnie Raitt. That's going on the record. Fuck Bonnie Raitt and fuck August and everything after. So I put that song and threw it away. And I realized also it was sort of flawed, so I didn't think much about it. And then about 10 years ago, maybe, we got an offer to do some orchestral shows. Mm-hmm. And we got this guy, Vince Mendoza, who I think is a genius, to do arrangements of Counting Crows songs. And he had heard like a clip of August and everything after and wanted to do an orchestral arrangement of that. And he did, and it was so good. So a couple years ago, we went back in the studio with him and an orchestra, and he wrote it for bass, drums, pedal steel, and me. And then, you know, a large London studio orchestra. And we recorded this version of it. And by that gave me a chance to rewrite it. And I fixed the parts that I thought were shitty. Mm-hmm. And so we put it on Amazon a few years ago as an exclusive, but it reverted to us. So we thought it would be a good B-side for the suite.
That's
so
funny. That it's probably one of the only times a title track comes out almost 30 years later. That's just kind of a wild. And also the fact that you decided to keep the name of the album, even though the song was no longer on there, is also kind of an interesting little footnote of the Counting Crows history.
It was a great album title.
Yeah, it is a good
I was album. Born in August. Everything about the album happened after that.
Oh, that's that where that cat didn't know that. That's
well,
awesome.
I mean, I was born in August, so the songs are about my life. So August and everything after seemed like a good title for us for our first album.
That's great. And then you speaking about collaborations, I love the Sixth Avenue Heartache you did with the Wallflowers a million years ago. You've always written for people and been a part of collaborating with other artists. That's a big part of your career as well.
Well, I don't do a ton of it. I'm not seeking out like big collaborations, but I do love singing on friends' records. I love doing background vocals, so I'll do it for friends. I mostly just do it on friends' albums, so a lot of them are things people never hear. But that one, you know, I knew Jake from the Viper Room. They had a first album that hadn't done very well. They got dropped by their label. And we were sitting in the office one day, and he was sort of talking to me about it. I had heard some of his newer songs. I thought they were really good. And I said, you just need a producer who gets what you're doing. You know, I recommended T-Bone to him, and they used T-Bone on that album. And then they were recording, and I got a phone call. It was when I still lived in Laurel Canyon. And I got a phone call one night, either from T-Bone or from Andy Slater, who was who still is Jake's manager. Mm-hmm. And they just said, we have this song. It's sitting a little flat. We think it's really good, but it's just not hitting. It wasn't one of the ones I'd heard, so I said, I don't know it. And they said, well, can you just come down and sing on it anyways and see what you think? And I said, okay. So I drove down over the hill to the valley. They were working at, I think, record one on Ventura. So had a beer, listened to the song, had another beer and sang it once or twice maybe, and then had another beer and then went home. It was pretty simple. I'm really proud of that one too, because background vocals, man, you need to make someone, you need to be really good, but not in a way that takes over. You got to do it in a way that makes them sound better and really supports them. And it really made that song. It was so good, and it's a great song. And but it was a little flat. I don't know what it is. Sometimes you just need one last touch on something. And I felt really great about that because it was their first single, and I feel like it really helped their career. It got them started, got the world ready to hear One Headlight, which made them enormous.
Yeah, that was a great song too. Yeah.
And by the way, it's everything a background vocal should be.
When we go for our food journeys, I'll talk to you about my new album because I do need a little backing tracks that just, they're not hitting right.
I'm your man.
All right, so Shannon, let's hit the first.
The first time ever I saw.
As you know, the name of the show is the SDR Show, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. We've asked every guest this since the dawn of time, and these should be interesting about your first experience with all three, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. We start with rock and roll, and we mean the first concert you went to on your own volition. Like, I want to go see this. Your mother didn't drag you there. Your brother, you know, whatever. This is a show. I want to go see this show, and you went to go see the show.
Well, my first concert, period, was Jackson 5. As a
Whoa.
Kid, my parents took me to see the Jackson 5 at a rodeo in Texas. It was awesome. I think it was 1970.
At a rodeo?
At a rodeo.
They were playing, because we went on two different days. I went one day and my sister went the other day. She saw Sonny and Cher the next day, and I saw the Jackson 5. So, like, it's also the first record I bought right then. I don't exactly remember what the first one is I went to on my own volition.
Well, I'll take Jackson 5, though. That's still very cool. Yeah. And, boy, your sister got screwed.
Yeah, was Sonny and Cher at a rodeo, too, or was that at a monster truck rally?
Yeah, it was two different days at the rodeo. They didn't have monster truck rallies then. They hadn't invented either monsters or trucks. So
Monsters came out both. Around 99. I remember. Okay, now, the first drug you ever did after pot, unless weed's the worst drug you've ever done, or not the first drug you've ever done.
So it's got to be coke or shrooms. I'm not sure.
Was it back when you were running backstage to, quote, look at the lyrics?
Yes, it was much earlier than that. I stopped doing drugs at 20 or 21.
Oh, really? Totally.
No, I stopped then. I had already gotten it way out of my system. I was an early adopter.
Oh, good.
You know, and I was really good at it. As I remember, I loved it.
Are you sober now? You've been sober your whole life? Or?
Fuck no. But no, I can't. Drugs, the dissociation hits drugs, and it just everything turns into an acid trip.
Oh,
it's not
good.
Wow. It's really, really unpleasant, so I had to stop. But no, I love drinking. Okay, I think it's fantastic. I own a winery.
I've read that. Yeah, you own a winery. That's cool. Yeah, I should have put two and two together.
Huge fan of alcohol.
Oh, good,
I mean, I'm a huge fan of pot, too, and I wish I could still smoke it. I just can't. I have a Pavlovian reaction when I think about it, though. I start to salivate.
Wow.
I love it so much. I can't touch it. But I love to roll joints. I love to see it. Although I get so much spit in my mouth when I think about pot.
That's sexy. Yeah. And now, the first time you had sex, and it better not be that it was with either Jennifer or Courtney, because I'll cry, but let's hear about the first time you had sex.
Unless it was them together. Then touchdown, baby. Touchdown.
By the way, I shouldn't ask it, but was there any anger when you went from one friend star to the other in the same year? Was either one of them pissed at it?
Yeah.
All right, we'll move on. You don't have to answer.
I didn't talk about them.
Fair enough.
But I think,
enough.
Yeah, but there's a popular misconception that, and I was a victim of this as well. You know, they're not actually who they play on TV.
Well, I realize that.
No, it's funny because it seems perfect. I mean, in the movies, they're so, and then you fall so, and it's strangely not like that in real life. Weird thing. Not that those. I mean, Jennifer, what a nice girl. She really is, lovely person.
Courtney, the worst.
What a bitch.
I'll take the.
By the way, Friends reunion comes out today.
Oh wow! Yeah, boy, I'm not talking about things I'm not lining up to see. So now, the first time you had sex, how old were you?
17.
17, and was it a love? Was it a one-off thing? Was it?
I was in high school chorus. And my chorus teacher's sister ran the high school chorus at Granada Hills High School in L.A., mm-hmm. where John Elway went to high school. And we would take these trips and to go visit them, and they would come to visit us. And we and when we were when they were with us, there were like 90 of them and 30 of us. So we would get three of them each. And when we went to visit them, we'd stay at their houses. And it was like crazy unsupervised time. I guess it was the closest thing to band camp. You know, so I was never in band. I don't know. But at my senior year, when they came up, I had been staying with this one girl my whole time. And her and two other girls stayed with me. And one of them was this super cool surfer chick, like L.A. surfer chick. Tall, long blonde hair. She always wore a red bandana. I mean, she couldn't, like, hair kind of bleached from, like, the sun. And just, we had this big party at one of my friend's houses, and we all crashed there for the 3 days. And we had to drive a bunch of people home one night back from Oakland to Berkeley. And her, she said she'd go with me, and we drove them home. And I was like, I'm a little drunk. I need to not drive. I pulled over. And we ended up making out in the car. And then it was like my parents had this new Mazda 626 that we had borrowed. And like the back seats folded down, they were part of the trunk. The trunk was filled with blankets and pillows because we were bringing them over because we were all crashing this house.
They had like a little mood lighting in there for some reason.
Yeah, I mean, it was crazy. We were parked on the side of the road somewhere in Berkeley. I've never been able to find. It must have been a couple blocks from my parents' house. I've never been able to find where it was. But we were making out in the back of the car. And she said something. And I thought she meant something else, like, do you want me to? And I was like, yeah. I thought she meant, like, maybe go down on me or something. And she just climbed on top of me. And it was the greatest thing ever. And I was just like, it was so relaxed and unpressured and wonderful and fun. It was just, like, the perfect experience.
That's a great first experience. I mean, it's nice to hear.
It maybe because it wasn't part of a relationship, but it also wasn't like some of this dirty thing. It was cool. She was just like also like a dream girl from a movie, kind of. She was just like, I'm a kid from Berkeley and Oakland. She's this LA chick in faded jeans and like, I don't know what she was doing in chorus even. She had, you know, the bandana and the long blonde hair that was like, she was a surfer chick, you know, and she just.
Could she sing?
Who knows? There's 90 of them. I don't know. I fucking no idea. She did everything else. She was magnificent and incredible and just she ran the whole show.
That's fucking great. And then I'm just the last question. Then we'll do the plugs and wrap it up. Gilby Clark was on the show a couple months ago and he coined this term where he called the word rock star sex, which was the first time a girl had sex with him because he was who he was. Like a groupie, I guess you'd call it. But he vividly remembered the first time he was backstage somewhere and a girl worked her way into the dressing room. And he's like, oh, this is finally happening. My first groupie experience. And now every time we've had a rock star on, we've asked that question as a follow-up. Does that stick out or no? And if it doesn't, it doesn't. But just
no, I don't know. I don't think so. Okay, but I think they've all been having sex with me because of who I am. Isn't that the honest heart-wrenching truth of it?
I guess that's true.
I don't know. There was one time where I came on the bus and my bus driver just kept giggling into his hand. I was, you know, we had a shower in the back of the bus and he's like, he thought it was so funny.
I'm like, was he a little Asian girl laughing like that?
No, he's an anime character. And hello. I don't know what it was, but I couldn't figure out what was going on. I went in the back, I got undressed, I opened the shower. There's three girls in the shower.
Oh my God.
And I have to tell you that my first thought is this is the most outrageous, erotic rock star experience of my life. This is so awesome. And my second thought was, actually, what do I do now? Like, this is so, it was so awkward and uncomfortable.
And the third thought was, water is not a good lubricant. I think they were really excited to
get in the shower. And nobody knew what to do. It was actually not sexual, not erotic, and just kind of like uncomfortable. We all took a shower and then we got dressed and they left and nothing. Oh. It was like, I realized I couldn't take part in this and I didn't know what to do and they didn't know what to do and they seemed uncomfortable. And I'm like, I don't want to be making anybody uncomfortable. I can't, I'm not that guy. I don't know what to do. We just all, I guess, pass me the shampoo. And yeah, no, if you want to wash the shampoo out, that's great. I should get dressed. Let me get you a towel. It was just all, it turned into like 12-year-old stuff and it was really not cool.
At the end of it, you're like, thank you, m'lady, for the shower. And that was the end of it.
Basically.
All right, so the new album, or EP rather, Butter Miracle Suite 1, is out. And the second one's coming in the fall. Your, and Counting Crows as well, is at Counting Crows on Twitter, which is your official and
Counting Crows. CountingCrows.com has all the dates that are coming up. Maybe a second one coming out by the end of the year. Who knows? Let's leave it out as a maybe. But I think there's probably tour dates already on schedule for you guys.
Tour dates are on the schedule. They're not going to go on sale for a couple weeks, but I think they're on our website now. There's no way there will be another record in the fall. Okay. There's no time to record it because we have to go on tour. But I think early next year I would like to have it done. Yeah.
All right, I like that. All right, let's run around the room real quick. James, your plugs.
Okay, V. James Madden on the Instagrams, TikTok, Commissioner Comedy Podcast, all about the passion and the inside game of comedy. It's dope. I have a single out where I do a joke with the band that Ralph was making fun of earlier, but it's the best. It's called Peanut Allergy. I'm on, hey, Adam, you'll appreciate this. I'm on playlists. Spotify put this track with like Joy Division. Fuck yeah, dog. Fuck yeah.
Yeah, it's also on a playlist called Don't Let This Happen to You. It's a separate playlist.
Which is ranked number one playlist in America, dog.
And also, every bit as funny as Joy Division.
Buddy, I am the Ian Curtis of comedy. I hang myself every time singing Love Will Tear Us Apart. Also, by the time this is out, I have recorded my new album and special Check Spot. It is me doing a Q&A while drunk people pay their bill at a comedy club. It is my metal machine music of comedy albums. And Adam, could you be in any cooler? This interview was great, and it also looks like you were at the Metropolitan Museum of Art the whole time. So this is the greatest thing ever. So God
when we do the Underwater Sunshine Festival, we set up this. I have this part of my house that's got a AstroTurf lawn because it's got lots of light, and so it's got beach furniture in this lawn. And we set up my friend Felipe's paintings. He did the cover for cool. For Somewhere Under Wonderland, and the bands play here. We record 40 bands over the course of that week, acoustic sessions here in the house. That's my Mellotron behind me.
All right, Shannon, your plugs, and we'll wrap this up.
Follow me on Instagram and TikTok at ShannonLee6982 and listen to my podcast, The Thing Is Ding. We talk about bad dates, fighting, and ghosts.
I like how you reluctantly say TikTok now. Me too.
Because I don't really do anything
there. I hate it so much. Adam, do you believe in ghosts, yes or no?
I don't know.
I like that answer. That's fair enough. All right, just follow me everywhere at I Am Ralph Sutton, and my health and wellness podcast with the founder of Juice Press called Good Sugar Podcast comes out every Monday. But honestly, Adam, dude, you're a fucking cool dude, as I knew you would be, thanks to my brother telling me about meeting you 25 years ago.
We got to do the food. We'll do the
food thing for sure. And let's add a song of the week. Pick a song off the new record that you want us to add to the playlist.
I guess I'm supposed to say Elevator Boots, but if I can pick anything, I'll tell you Bobby and the Rat Kings. It's killer.
Okay, we'll add that to the playlist, and we'll see you all next week on the SDR Show. Peace.
I'm an elevator kid pushing buttons when I want to go home. My generation hasn't even got a name of its own. We just buy what the TV sells, and it almost never stop wishing we were somebody else. But tonight, in the dark, I can be myself. When Bobby and the Rat Kings come to play, we'll make them stay, we'll make them play. I'll play till the stars all fade, we'll make them stay till dawn.
Listening to the SDR Show.